journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just a second. Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, the daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, January 17th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
An update on Afghanistan as the Taliban opens an office, and the video of four U.S. Marines sparks debates, plus Rinku Sen on race and racism in this year's presidential elections, and why local activists are denouncing L.A.'s jail expansion plans, plus the Civic Circus with Ankur Patel. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. A well-known Pashtun leader outspoken against the Taliban was assassinated in Kandahar, Afghanistan today. Mohammad Naheem Agha Mama was gunned down inside a mosque while he prayed. Naheem, a tribal leader, was known for organizing against the Taliban in his local council. His is the latest in a string of killings that began last year of high-profile members of the Afghan central and provincial governments that the Taliban have taken credit for. But even while the extrajudicial killings are taking place, reports surfaced last week of an unusual event. The Taliban were opening an office in the Gulf Arab state of Qatar. Taking this to mean that the radical fundamentalist group was ready to negotiate with the U.S. and NATO, commentators have called it a breakthrough in the Afghanistan war. However, the Taliban's motives remain unclear after having boycotted last December's conference in Bonn, Germany. One unnamed senior Western intelligence official speaking to the London Telegraph said, quote, "Despite the opening of the Qatar office, we have received no indication that the Taliban are serious about engaging in serious peace talks. So far as we can tell, the Taliban is simply playing a waiting game." Yet the New York Times and others have reported of months-long efforts by the U.S. and Taliban to meet in secret. Leading Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney criticized the Obama administration during a debate this weekend for attempting to negotiate with the Taliban. And meanwhile, news of the scandalous video of four U.S. Marines urinating on Afghan corpses that may be Taliban has sparked a new point of debate among candidates vying for the U.S. presidency. Texas Governor Rick Perry has defended the Marines against Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's description of the act as utterly despicable. The infamous video could result in criminal charges against the Marines now that a military investigation has been announced. Joining me on the phone now is Gareth Porter. He's a frequent guest on Uprising. He's an investigative historian and journalist specializing in U.S. national security policy and the Afghanistan war. He writes for Interpress Service. Welcome back to Uprising, Gareth.
Thanks for having me again, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about the killing of this tribal leader, Mohammad Naheem Agha Mama. People may remember, listeners may remember, last year the top two most high-profile killings were those of Karzai's own brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai in Kandahar, and Barnahuddin Rabbani, a former prime minister of Afghanistan. Is this killing just the sort of ongoing tactic by the Taliban to intimidate the Afghan government?
Yeah, I think this is another chapter in what I've described as the Taliban ability to essentially control the narrative of this conflict, of this war, by being able to carry out spectacular killings right within the Karzai government's most secure places, and presumably, being able to target a high-ranking leader who was organizing against the Taliban would be another target in that series, similar to the killings that you've mentioned in your intro. And I do think that from everything that I've been hearing from people who've come back from Afghanistan who have served there in the U.S. military, the Taliban are successful in general within the Pashtun area in basically having their version of what is really happening in this conflict be credible to the population. In other words, I think most Pashtuns believe that once the Americans leave, the Taliban will be left as the primary authority in the zone, generally speaking, despite the fact that there are, of course, Karzai government officials at the district level and security units, both army and police, scattered throughout the zone. Nevertheless, those institutions do not have the credibility at this point that they would need in order to combat that narrative, the war narrative that the Taliban have successfully put forward.
Should we be surprised that the U.S. is not only talking about talking to the Taliban, but has likely been doing so in secret for a while, even as the Taliban is picking off one by one the U.S.'s allies in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it was always inevitable that the United States would have to begin negotiating with the Taliban. This was, in fact, a question that was raised from the beginning by the Obama administration, by President Obama himself. And I remember writing a story about this in March of 2009, based on a New York Times piece that quoted Obama in a meeting at the White House on Afghanistan, saying maybe it's time to start talking to the Taliban. This was in the context of the military claiming some major progress in the counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan, and the president clearly was hoping to use that as a lever for saying, okay, well, now should we begin that process? And the military, of course, said no. The pro-war contingent within the Obama administration, meaning Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, supported the military leadership in that regard, and I think it's very clear that Obama retreated in 2009 and 2010, but that was clearly always in the back of his mind, and something that I regard as inevitable. Looking at the history of the Vietnam War, the United States was making the kind of demands on their adversary that the Obama administration, the military, have been making on the Taliban, more or less give up, lay down your arms, and accept the political order that we've created, and we'll be glad to stop fighting you and withdraw our troops. That is exactly what the United States was demanding in 1965 and 66 and 67 in Vietnam. And, of course, by 68, they were beginning to sit down with the Viet Cong, with the Vietnamese communists, in a process that took many years, but which eventually resulted in the U.S. withdrawal. And I think the question for, the question surrounding these negotiations is, how soon will the United States agree to put forward a timetable for complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan?
Well, I want to quote President Hamid Karzai in an interview, actually in a statement that he made at the in Kabul. He said, "Afghanistan to save the country from war, conspiracies, the killing of innocent Afghans, and to reach peace agrees with the talks between U.S. and the Taliban that will end up in establishing an office for the Taliban in Qatar." It's amazing that more than 10 years after this war started, you have the Afghan central government that was established by the U.S. Against the Taliban. You have the Taliban and you have the United States that have been locked in a bitter battle that has resulted in thousands dead, eventually coming to some sort of agreement that would likely leave the Taliban in power. And it sort of makes you question what the last 10 years were all about after all.
Well, it's not clear at all how this is going to play out in terms of particularly the aspect of the negotiations that is supposed to deal with what happens in the political system of Afghanistan itself. In other words, the negotiations between the Karzai regime and the Taliban over the future political order. There was, as you may recall, a model for how negotiations, three-part negotiations, U.S., Taliban, Karzai, might play out, which was put forward by some former Taliban who had been advising President Karzai on how to negotiate with the Taliban. And this was in 2000, in early 2010, 2009, 2010, that they put forward this this what they call a roadmap to peace negotiation and to an agreement. And what they were suggesting was that there is a precedent that would have to be followed in terms of how the issues would be dealt with. And the first one would have to be the international aspect of this. That is to say, the presence of foreign troops would have to be resolved first.
Right.
And that, of course, is the Taliban position, and it has not, they've not wavered on that. But they said once there is agreement in principle or you know, fundamental agreement on how that would be handled, then they could move on to questions that had to do with the Afghanistan political order, and that would involve questions of how to change the constitutional the present constitution of Afghanistan. And you know, they said the Taliban have various suggestions or proposals for how the constitution should be changed, that they could live with a constitution if it were amended, particularly with regard to the role of Islam and with regard to the role of Islamic clerics in the political system, that they would want to beef up, they would want to have a more powerful role for Islamic clerics in the political system.
So, as though they aren't powerful enough already. I mean, given what the Karzai government has done, the kinds of Islamic clerics that he has appointed over these many years that have resulted in severely high numbers of imprisonment of women, for example, for so-called honor killings. It's just remains to be seen how future Afghanistan might look. I want to turn to this video of the U.S. Marines urinating on corpses that supposedly are Taliban corpses and what role this may be playing between U.S.-Taliban relations. You know, from the perspective of the U.S., this video surfacing may be pretty bad timing, but has it had any effect?
Well, I don't know that it's going to change anything fundamentally. Of course, it's this kind of thing, you know, similar to the episode in which there were demonstrations throughout Afghanistan protesting the alleged desecration of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are the kinds of things that are definitely going to create, you know, a lot of anger within the population of Afghanistan, there's no doubt that this is going to have that effect. But on the other hand, it doesn't change the fundamental dynamics of the conflict, and there's no surprise here for anyone who understands the nature of foreign military sent into a country to occupy it and carry out war against local resistance. I mean, you know, this is the same story as we had in Vietnam and in Iraq, where American troops inevitably, you know, even before they arrived, they had racist ideas about the local population. And as they interacted from a distance, obviously, and across a divide of great distrust and from the side of the local population, for the most part, fear and loathing of foreign presence, they quickly, you know, they accelerate their feelings of racist disdain, fear and hatred of the local population generally. And so, you know, this is the inevitable consequence of a foreign occupation in a situation like Afghanistan.
I'm speaking with Gareth Porter, investigative historian and journalist specializing in U.S. national security policy and the Afghanistan war. He writes for Interpress Service and is a frequent guest here on Uprising. Gareth, I want to ask you to comment on several statements made by Republican candidates vying for their party's nomination for the presidential ticket this November. First, Mitt Romney saying that the U.S. should not negotiate with the Taliban. He's saying the right course for America is not to negotiate with the Taliban while the Taliban Taliban are killing our soldiers. The right course is to recognize that they are the enemy of the United States. And he said, we don't negotiate from a position of weakness as we are pulling our troops out. We should not negotiate with the Taliban. We should defeat the Taliban. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, this, of course, is the so-called moderate position within the Republican Party.
Right.
That is to say, the position that is acceptable to the powers that be in Washington, D.C. And so, you know, this is a clear signal that Mitt Romney is a candidate who will obviously get along with the U.S. military, the Pentagon. You know, he wants to have a position that is acceptable to them. I think that this is a position that the Republican base is profoundly confused over and has very conflicting views about. There are many in the Tea Party who support that. There are many in the Tea Party who are tired of the war in Afghanistan and who support Ron Paul's position that the United States should get out yesterday or last year. I think that this is a an issue where it's not at all clear that Romney has support from the Republican base, clear-cut majority support for this. On the contrary, I think it's probably the case that most Republicans, if asked, most Republican voters in the primaries would say that they're in favor of getting out as soon as possible, and they don't accept the idea that that the United States doesn't negotiate as we're withdrawing. That's an absurd position, of course. That's when you want to negotiate. If you don't have the stamina, the strength to be able to keep your troops in a country for a long, long period of time, then obviously you have to negotiate.
Especially if all you're interested in is getting your troops out. Rick Perry has defended the four Marines in their the scandal around the four Marines and the video showing that they are urinating on Afghan corpses. Leon Panetta, defense secretary, called the act utterly despicable. And there's been a lot of denunciation of what happened and what was shown. But Rick Perry said, let me tell you what's utterly despicable. Cutting Daniel Pearl's head off and showing the video of it, hanging our contractors from bridges, that's utterly despicable, referring to the American journalist who very early in the Afghanistan war was beheaded by insurgents. And he's defended that position that he has taken. What does this say, not just about the way in which foreign policy is discussed in the U.S., particularly during a presidential election, but what does it also say about the logic, the kind of perverse logic that we often hear from the military?
Well, I think, my view of the kind of view that you get from Rick Perry or Newt Gingrich, for that matter, in this campaign, which is now, you know, has become the dominant sort of viewpoint of the Republican Party, is that it represents the kind of Islamophobic response that has been that the Republican Party has decided to tap and essentially to magnify in this campaign. And it's one of the most unfortunate and frightening developments, really, in American culture and politics, from my point of view. So, I mean, I think that it really reflects a much deeper sickness of this society and political system that really demands the attention of thinking people in the United States, that really the Islamophobic phenomenon, which has been really encouraged by the Republicans in a most tawdry and cynical way, particularly by Gingrich more than anyone else.
Right.
This is something that really demands a pushback from people who care about the future of this country.
Well, Gareth Porter, I want to thank you very much, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you again, Finale.
Gareth Porter is an investigative historian and journalist specializing in U.S. national security policy and the Afghanistan war. He's a frequent guest here on Uprising and writes for Interpress Service. This is Uprising, and after this short break, we'll be joined on the phone by Rinku Sen to discuss race and racism in this year's presidential elections. And then we'll also hear this week's edition of Civic Circus with Ankur Patel. Finally, we'll take a look at the plans to expand LA's jail system and why activists here are up in arms about it. Stay tuned.
Go back to sleep and dream. Tip down your pink sombrero. Today was a time machine that's broken down in tomorrow. And I know by the sound of the rain as it falls on the ground that this love is a shelter with holes. If we stay here too long, we'll be drenched to the bone. Go back to sleep and dream. Cling to the ones that you love.
Monday by ALO from San Francisco, California. You can visit them online at alomusic.com or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. 3 years into the first term of America's first black president, racism is not only nowhere near over, it is a major feature of this year's election. GOP candidates for the 2012 Republican presidential nominees are becoming increasingly caustic toward one another, but most have managed to make a common enemy of people of color. This year, so far at least, America's greatest ills are not being blamed so much on immigrants or Muslims as on an imagined population of poor black Americans living comfortably on taxpayer dollars. At a town hall event days before the New Hampshire primary, Newt Gingrich told a group, quote, "I'll go to the NAACP convention and talk about why the African American community should demand paychecks and not be satisfied with food stamps." During campaigning for the Iowa caucus, Rick Santorum infamously told a group of journalists and voters, quote, "I don't want to make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money." Shawnee O'Hilton at colorlines.com earlier this month highlighted findings from Capital Words on the most uttered racial euphemisms in Washington. Far more Democrats than Republicans used the coded term urban to describe city areas with a significant population of people of color. Republicans, for their part, favor the term racial preference as a stand-in for affirmative action when opposing laws and policies that promote equality. The word Hilton dubbed the dirtiest of words in Washington, however, is the word racism itself, said by members of Congress only 46 times last year. Meanwhile, the issue has become a hot topic of debate within left-leaning and progressive circles. The welcome mat some prominent progressives have put out for Ron Paul is forcing a debate on what racist expression looks like and where fighting racial inequality sits on the totem pole of progressive politics. Rinku Sen is the president and executive director of the Applied Research Center and the publisher of colorlines.com. She now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Rinku.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, as I mentioned earlier, the African-American low-income population in the United States seems to be this year's bogeyman, whereas in past years it's been Muslims, immigrants, etc. Why do you think that this year we're seeing this particular target?
Well, I think it's a little early to determine who's going to be the target for the entire election season. I think that African Americans are really accustomed to being that target. Many, many election cycles have focused on their, you know, what is required to get the African American community moving. And so it's not surprising that they're an early target, but I don't think that they're going to be the only one. I think that the election, much of the frame, the way the election is framed, is going to be about stereotyping people of color as freeloaders and as terrorists. I think those will be the two big frames, and between them they will cover all of us, black folks, South Asians, Latinos, Arabs, and American Indians. I'm sure will get their share, probably in the freeloader mix.
Right. I want to play for you and our listeners a clip of Ron Paul defending himself on CNN on December 20th about questions regarding the racist newsletters published in his name.
There's been some talk again, resurfaced talk, about some things that you that were written in a newsletter under your name. 2008, The New Republic, James Kirchick attributed some comments to you in newsletters where you referred to disturbances in Washington's Adams Morgan as animals taking over the D.C. Zoo, referring to African Americans. You said that Martin Luther King seduced underage girls and boys. You talked about Ronald Reagan proclaiming annual Hate Whitey Day with Martin Luther King Day, and you advocated prohibiting AIDS patients from eating in restaurants. These things were published under your name.
Yeah, but I didn't write them, and I disavowed them.
Right, but you're a presidential candidate. That's tough, right? I mean, it kind of comes back to bite you that you made money off of things that were published under your name that were hateful and racist.
Yeah, but this has been addressed for 20 years, and nobody accuses me of that type of beliefs or language. I'm a true civil libertarian, and I think people dig these up when people think that, oh, his economic policies are winning, his foreign policies are winning, his monetary policies are winning. So they have to dig these things up, which they really can't pin on me because they've been disavowed, and they are old. They've been rehashed. Just go back and read all the articles, and there's all the explanations. So, yes, it wasn't good, and but I didn't write them, and those aren't my beliefs, so I sleep well.
Ron Paul speaking to CNN. Rinku Sen, he says he sleeps well at night, and a lot of progressive support for Ron Paul also discounts these racist newsletters that were published in his name. Tom Hartman wrote a lengthy defense of Ron Paul, saying he isn't really racist. How do you respond to this?
Well, the problem with pinning down what is and isn't racist and who is and isn't racist is that we get stuck in a conversation about intention. Is Ron Paul intentionally racist? And does he embrace racism? Does he actually overtly and consciously hate black people, for example? And the problem with that claim is that there's no way ever to know, in spite of what Ron Paul says. He says it's 20 years ago, it was other people. And for us to focus on proving that Ron Paul actually believed these things that were published under his names or that he continues to believe them today, it's very difficult to make that case. And, you know, the truth is we don't really know. Now, if we look at Ron Paul's policy agenda, then we can draw some conclusions about the ways in which his policy stances might affect people of color, the way that they might grow racial inequity or close the gap. And what we find in his policy stances is a mixed bag, frankly. Some things, which is what libertarians usually produce, in some areas we would be grateful to have less intervention into our lives, and in others we need more. I think that the problem with Ron Paul from the perspective of communities of color is that he wants to shrink and shrink and shrink the government. He doesn't essentially believe in having a government that does very much. And people of color need a robust government to protect us from discrimination and to promote actual equity and the policies and practices that close the racial gap.
So you're saying that that's more his policy on the undermining of government programs is even more dangerous than what he may or may not have said or espoused in the past?
I think those two things go together, but if we're thinking about where we need to focus the public debate, I do think it has to be on the policies. It's perfectly legitimate to point out that he said things about people of color or that he might believe them, but I think just as a proportion of what we're contributing to the political debate, that we can't win that fight. It'll just go around again and again and again. People saying he's racist, him saying he's not, and there's no end to that.
Well, Rinku Sen, what about this very interesting clip of Rick Santorum that has also received a lot of attention? I want to play it for you and our listeners, not only when he said this controversial statement about black people, but then his defense of it, saying that he didn't really say black people.
It just keeps expanding. I was in Indianola a few months ago, and I was talking to someone who works at the Department of Public Welfare here, and she told me that the state of Iowa is going to get fined if they don't sign up more people under the Medicaid program. They're just pushing harder and harder to get more and more of you dependent upon them so they can get your vote. That's what the bottom line is. I don't want to make people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. I want to give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money and provide for themselves and their families.
Mark Morial, the president of the National Urban League, sent something the other day, and I want to give you a chance to respond to it. He was talking about a comment you made at a rally out in Iowa this past Sunday, and you told an audience there that you don't want to, quote, make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. How would you respond to that, Senator?
I've looked at that quote. In fact, I looked at the video, and I'm pretty confident I didn't say black. What I think, I started to say a word and sort of mumbled it and changed my thought.
Rick Santorum saying he didn't really say black people. Not sure what he thinks he said, but Rinku Sen, what do you make of this defense? This is sort of a new kind of defense against a statement that was clearly uttered.
This has to be one of the most hilarious disavowals in election history in the United States. And I just imagine politicians creating lists of words that sound like the words that they will want to deny having said at some point so that they can pull them up as evidence that I was really saying this. I think, you know, here we see Rick Santorum heading straight into that intersection of stereotypes that people believe and public policies that actually shape our lives. And so Rick Santorum clearly is operating off of the freeloader stereotype. He talked about not making black people's lives better by giving them someone else's money. That someone else, of course, would be white people. He doesn't bother to actually name where the redistribution he's imagining is coming from. And I think this is a very legitimate place for us to level critique, both in terms of the stereotypes that Rick Santorum holds about what black people want, what black communities want. I don't think, for both him and Gingrich, I would be hard pressed to find a black person who would say, oh, I would rather have food stamps than a paycheck. The problem is that we can't get access to either. Communities of color can't, and therefore we're just abandoned. So this is clearly Rick Santorum pulling up a public policy bug that has been repeated again and again and again in many election cycles in the United States, and relying on that to get people not to look too deeply at the public policies that he supports, which, of course, would hurt many, many white people as well as black and Latino and Asian.
Rinku Sen, I asked you earlier about why you think African-Americans are a target during this early election season. And I want to come back to that. And certainly you quite rightly said that the election season is still quite early. We will see more targets. But how much of what we're seeing now has to do with the fact that we have a black president in office, and that that harnessing anti-African-American racism for Republicans can provide to be, you know, a useful method of gaining traction among the hate Obama crowd? The attacks on Michelle Obama are quite illustrative as well. President Obama, of course, gets his constant share of attacks, but Michelle Obama's, the attacks on her are really quite significant as well. She's been characterized as an angry black woman, and then some very, very insulting remarks that, you know, I don't want to even dignify on the air here. How do you respond to that?
Well, I have been thinking about what the racialized attack on President Obama will look like in this period. I think the birth certificate thing is played out. I think we'll see a little bit of he's secretly a Muslim in some circles. But I think that the food stamp president is what is going to carry the day on the GOP side. And, of course, the food stamp president refers much more directly than either of the other two, birth certificate or secret Muslim memes. It refers much more directly to a stereotype of black Americans. So the line will not be so much that he is a foreigner, but rather that he is a freeloader. He comes from a people, a freeloading people, so to speak. And I think that we're going to see that, you know, he's a food stamps president. He wants to generate a lot of dependency. He wants to take money from white people and give it to black people. We're going to see that's very likely to be the primary meme. I think in terms of Michelle, what the attacks show to us really, I think, is that there are very deep ways in which gender roles and gender norms, what it means to be a good political wife, are deeply racialized. So the notion that she is angry, the notion that she controls a lot of what the president does, that she oversteps her boundaries, many of those notions are based on an image on the idea that she does not properly fulfill the image of a first lady, that image being historically white.
Let's also talk about the way in which we don't see very much criticism coming from progressives of this. I mean, you're writing of a handful of progressives on, for example, Ron Paul and the racism linked to him have really been the exceptions rather than the rule. And I'm wondering, as we're seeing the Occupy movement take full force, and we had you on about issues of racism, and accusations of whether or not the Occupy movement was diverse enough, questions around that. How do you assess American progressives taking on election issues and particularly taking on issues of race and racism? Do you see enough anger towards race and towards racism in among GOP candidates in particular?
I think that American progressives have actually still a great deal to learn about racism and how it works today in this particular context. It's not the same way in which it worked 40 years ago or 100 years ago, or even in some cases 10 years ago, given the cultural shift that's taken place because we have a black president. I think the problem with progressives and their stance toward race is that unlike other issues where progressives will take a policy approach and a structural approach, they'll take unemployment, for example, and say, here are the policies that have actually generated the levels of unemployment we have, and here are the policies that we need to put in place to change the unemployment situation. They don't do the same when a racial question comes up. So rather than taking a structural approach that looks at institutions and at the rules when race arises, progressives tend to go to a very individualized place. And like most Americans, they mistakenly think that racism is always individual and overt and intentional, and that just is not those kinds of actions are far from being the only kinds of actions that generate racial divide and racial oppression in this country. Much of what generates the racial divide is actually seemingly race-neutral policies. And the problem for progressives is that they haven't learned how to talk about the policy implications of racial divides. And so they have to default to individual critique and critique of intention when they talk about race. And that doesn't really make sense to do in a political fight. You want to keep people focused not just on the personalities of the folks involved, but on what they're actually going to do with our rules and regulations and practices. And I think that that new definition of racism as a set of practices and policies and rules that create disadvantage for people of color and privilege for white people, that's a definition that progressives have not been able to really adequately wrap their heads around, and they need to get on it.
And you know, we still also hear progressives, particularly, again, going back to Ron Paul, that their support for Ron Paul is based on the fact that fighting imperialism is more important than worrying about racism right now. I mean, they may not say that overtly, but that's often implied.
Yes.
So just because Ron Paul is anti-war. Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is a hierarchy of issues implied in terms of what their importance is, and we just really can't go there. We have to have the ability as a progressive movement to hold the importance of multiple issues. It's a complicated world. And that doesn't mean that we can't choose particular things to talk about at particular times, but it does mean that we have to really avoid dismissing the importance of any particular issue, because it might not be so important to me, but I can guarantee that there is a community who really cares about that happening, welfare, food stamps, education, unemployment, as well as war.
Well, Rinku-san, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rinku-san is the president and executive director of the Applied Research Center and the publisher of colorlines.com. We're talking about race and racism in the presidential election season. This is Uprising, and after this week's Civic Circus, we'll take a look at Los Angeles's jail expansion plans and why activists are opposed. Stay tuned.
The power of the drum and the healing force of women's voices live on stage. Celebrating the groundbreaking exhibition, Women Hold Up Half the Sky, the Skirball Cultural Center presents LA's beloved all-woman percussion ensemble, Adawe, Friday, January 20th. With high-octane energy, Adawe fuses the ancient rhythms of Ghana and West Africa with R&B pop vocals, gospel harmonies, and uplifting lyrics that celebrate love, empowerment, and peace. Adawe at the Skirball, Friday, January 20th. For more information, call 310-440-4500 or visit kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor for Adawe at the Skirball.
Welcome to Civic Circus. I'm Ankur Patel, breaking down local politics. Going to 3-hour meetings so you don't have to. This week on Uprising, I'm going to take a look at the Los Angeles Unified School District. The LAUSD is the second largest school district in the United States, with a K-12 enrollment of 664,000 and a total enrollment of 919,000 students. The general fund for this fiscal year, 2011-2012, totaled $6.5 billion. That is after over $2 billion of cuts over the last 4 years has left us with a shortened school year, thousands fewer teachers, and forces us to re-examine all alternatives to traditional public schools. Now, I'm a product of the LAUSD magnet programs, which have actually been more successful as a whole than charter schools in LA. But the $543 million budget deficit facing LAUSD for the 2012-2013 fiscal year, largely created by the state's financial mismanagement and the politicization of education, has Superintendent John Deasy looking to the bottom of the barrel, an increase in property tax, to make up some of that gap. During the LAUSD school board meeting on Tuesday, January 10th, Deasy laid out in stark terms what the district was facing, making the case for a property tax that would range between $200 and $300. It would be up to the 7 school board members to put that tax on the November ballot for voter approval. Jerry Brown also hopes to get a half-cent sales tax for education on the November ballot. But the district won't know if they're going to be getting that tax revenue before they create the budget. In addition, there's a high likelihood that even if the money comes through to the district, it will be in the form of deferral payments, essentially IOUs. The fact that the budget is continually being cut, teachers are worried about their jobs, and the general lack of resources that our children get in their public schooling has led many people to move their children out of public school. The LAUSD has had a decline in enrollment of over 100,000 students since 2007. With a decrease in enrollment, the state, which provides funding based on the number of students, has also decreased, further exacerbating the problem. So the numbers are looking bad, both in terms of dollars, but also in terms of graduation rates. One idea that has been floating and will be discussed during the LAUSD board meeting today is the erasure of school boundaries. This challenges the concept of the neighborhood school, ideally allowing parents to choose the best option for their child. This would be a dramatic shift and is not being taken lightly, as the school board is voting today to approve the exploration of the idea in a formal report. Proponents are painting this as a way to empower parents and allow them more options for their children. Issues of fairness and priority of seats will have to be addressed, as specific schools would be more appealing to certain parents. But without teachers, four walls, a blackboard, and some desks do not a school make. So the LAUSD has also been coming up with and implementing innovative solutions to the budget problems, such as rehiring laid-off teachers at a discount by not providing benefits such as sick time or health care. Don't forget that lesser-known elected officials, like our school board members, are still politicians. Please follow me on Twitter at HardlyConscious. For Uprising, I'm Ankur Patel with Civic Circus.
Thanks, Ankur. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2011 to uphold a ruling for California to reduce overcrowding in its prisons, 25 counties in this state are being invited to apply for billions in funding to expand their jail systems. The money is being distributed statewide by the Corrections Standards Authority, which has already awarded hundreds of millions of dollars to more than 10 California counties for first phase of jail construction. Chief among the counties for Phase 2 funding is the LA County jail system, picked to top the priority list because it housed the most prisoners in the state to begin with. Los Angeles Sheriff Lee Baca, notorious for reports of torture and harsh conditions in his prison system and under local and federal scrutiny, has applied for a sum of $2.6 billion. The LA County Board of Supervisors is due to vote this month on approving Baca's application. But groups like the Eller Baker Center for Human Rights, the Youth Justice Coalition, and Californians United for a Responsible Budget are collecting signatures to petition the County Board of Supervisors to vote against the deal. They say LA has enough jails and that the best way to ease overcrowding is to stop imprisoning so many people in the first place. Violent crime in Los Angeles and nationwide is at an all-time low. A new report by the LAPD and LA Sheriff's Department found that crime in 2011 was significantly lower than in 2010. The LA Times quoted a spokesman for Sheriff Baca who said, quote, "Communities seem to be banding together to fight crime. We can't take the complete credit." Joining me in studio this morning is David Chavez. He's a movement builder with the Youth Justice Coalition. Welcome to Uprising, David.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, if the concern of so many advocates of prisoners' rights is that we have severe overcrowding in our prison system, and if that has led to the Supreme Court to say California needs to relieve its prison overcrowding, why then are groups like Youth Justice Coalition opposing the expansion of the jail system, which would at least relieve overcrowding?
So with the release of people who from state prison system, they are coming home. These folks are what are considered non, so they're nonviolent, non-sexual, non-serious people, or they committed non-serious crimes. And we're having people come home back to LA County. And the intention was behind that legislation, the first intention around, the federal lawsuit was to decrease overcrowding by letting people go.
Not by increasing the prison system.
Yeah, not by increasing the prison system. It goes in complete opposite of that. And also just a realignment, what Jerry Brown signed in last year, AB 109. Realignment is supposed to be releasing people who shouldn't have been in prison in the first place. People are there for technical parole violations. People who are in there are for issues of addiction shouldn't be in prison in the first place. So with this, it doesn't make sense to be expanding the jail system, something that's just going to cost so much money, and it's going to take at least 5 years to implement or to be finally constructed. And the money that you mentioned, the $2.6 billion, is only for the construction, has no money towards operations, no money towards the maintenance of the building or anything.
Mm. Well, what's really interesting is that Los Angeles County Jail System is number one in line to receive the money because it has the most prisoners to begin with. So the LA County Jail System is being rewarded for having too many prisoners, the most of any county jail system in the state to begin with in the first place, by being given more money to make that jail system even bigger. I mean, that just seems rather odd.
Yeah, and, it's really being led by Sheriff Lee Baca and his administration. They see that their main intent, or we believe as CURB, California's United for Responsible Budget, that their main agenda is to create job security for their officers and not really create safety. As any jail expansion or prison expansion in our state has shown, that the creation of more prison cells and more cages does not impact public safety in any way. And in fact, right now, the LA County jails have around 4,000 empty jail beds that are now not being used because of budget shortfalls in their own department. So they don't have the staffing for their empty cells that they do have. So
So why are they then pushing for jail expansion? Why is prison expansion so popular throughout the state?
Well, prison expansion in this state has for the last 25 years been extremely popular. And starting in the 1980s, we did in a 25-year period, we built 22 state prisons in California. And in that same period, we only built three universities. And it's something that's kind of pandemic within our state. And the reasons being are that instead of addressing real public safety, the idea of just of locking more people up provides job security for the sheriff's department, allows politicians to point to something very simple to say, look, this is how we're reducing crime, this is how we're reducing violence in our communities, is by locking people up.
And then do the prison guards union also hold sway in Sacramento?
Yes, most definitely. And at a state level, yes, the corrections officers union is one of the strongest unions in the entire state. But here locally, even in the county, the sheriff's department, you know, is very, very strong. It's mm-hmm. extremely strong. The words of Sheriff Lee Baca carry a lot of weight among all of our county supervisors. And because of that, it's very hard to push back against that.
And yet, this is a man who has come under national scrutiny, federal scrutiny, and local scrutiny. The ACLU has been doing reports. There's been media exposés of the torture and harsh conditions in the LA County jail system. And you're saying that he doesn't have enough staff for that system to begin with. And now he wants more money to construct new jails, not even accounting for the money that may be used to run it, which may lead to an even less accountable jail system with even more abuses in the future. How is it that he has so much weight in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think you just hit it right on the head. You know that Sheriff Lee Baca has presided over a drastic and deadly humanitarian crisis in LA, and also a nationwide crisis, as we're being looked at by investigated not only locally here, but also by like the federal government is also looking into the jail and the torture that is taking place there. And you're right, it is extremely overcrowded. Like me personally, my younger brother is in Side County Jail at the moment, and when my family and we go visit him, you know, there's about 8 to 10 officers in the reception area. Sheriff's officers who are there, who are supposed to be getting people inside to visit our loved ones. And half of them just are kind of standing around. And, you know, we are waiting in line for 3 hours, sometimes more, 4 hours to get a 20 minute visit. And and it's so inefficient, at least in that end. We feel like we're being, you know, I guess you can say criminalized as visitors. So I can only imagine what's happening to the young, to the men inside the county jail. And you're right. The ACLU report did a great expose on that and also other articles that have come out. And you would think that I would want to ask that same question to the county supervisors: is how can you want to give somebody or even listen to somebody who wants so much more money, $2.6 billion, to continue building new jail beds after having done such a horrible job at it? And not more than that, just not treating people with human dignity or respect or just basically what amounts to torture.
I'm speaking with David Chavez, who is the movement builder with the Youth Justice Coalition, and his group, along with the Yellow Baker Center for Human Rights and Californians United for a Responsible Budget, are organizing against the plans to expand Los Angeles's jail system. Now, let's talk about these realignment funds, the funds that have been allocated for prison expansion by the Corrections Standards Authority. Are those funds specifically, do they have to be used for jail expansion, or is there discretion with how these funds can be used?
Okay, so for realignment, the AB 109 money can be used at any type of discretion as long as it goes towards supporting the, like I said before, the non, the folks who are coming home, supporting them to be processed.
Non-violent, non-serious,
yeah.
Non-sexual crimes.
So that's what AB 109 money goes towards. And our county has already gotten over $130 million.
And what have they spent that on?
Well, I can tell you that less than 4% has gone to housing people, and the rest of it, so 96%, has gone to the sheriff's department for hiring more staff, and also the probation department for hiring more staff and creating what they're calling hub centers, I guess, as resource centers, which are highly ineffective. You don't have trained staff. Probation officers are not social workers, so they're not sure how to really address the needs of these folks who are coming home. So that's what's been spent that way. And then the sheriffs, what their money that they're going after is coming from AB 900, a law that was passed in 2007, which allocates billions of dollars towards prison construction here in a statewide level in California. And so the money that they are getting sent is, it can only be put towards construction. And it's one of those things that that they're using purposely to keep this anti-democratic, because AB 900 is what is called lease revenue bonds. And these bonds are don't go to a state vote. The reason being is that they're supposed to be used for something that'll to bring in income itself, for example, like a toll bridge, or for example, a toll highway, something like that.
So it's amazing that at a time when public school teachers are being laid off, when our education system is being gutted, which is of course intimately linked with health, mental and physical health of communities, that billions are going towards prison expansion. Finally, David, what does Youth Justice Coalition, what do your fellow activists and organizations want to happen? Are you specifically just targeting the LA County Board of Supervisors, saying do not approve the deal that Sheriff about the application of Sheriff Baca for these billions of dollars in funding?
Well, yes, that's one of our tactics. One is to for everyone to please call your county supervisors, find out what district you're in, and call them and tell them that yes, tell them no to the jail expansion, and specifically, you know, give them ideas about what we could use that $2.6 billion. I mean, if in LA County, if we were just to get $55 million, we could hire 500 registered nurses. If we had use another $50 million, we could have 400 people be hired onto the public health department. We can literally almost end homelessness at a cost of nearly $900 million to house people here in LA County. So definitely, one, call your county supervisors. Number two, come out on Tuesday, January 24th, next Tuesday at 9:30 a.m. to the County Board of Supervisors where they will be hearing a vote or hearing the argument from the Sheriff's Department. Number three, go to curbprisonspending.org. That's curbprisonspending.org, and sign our petition, which we're trying to get 1,000 signatures before next Tuesday. And then finally, tell other folks about it. Tell other folks to come through as well.
Well, curbprisonspending.org is that website. David Chavez, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
David Chavez is my guest. He's a movement builder with the Youth Justice Coalition. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Horace Mann once said, jails and prisons are the complement of schools. So many less as you have of the latter, so many more must you have of the former. That's Horace Mann. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Stein is our assistant producer. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to all of our interviews, rate them, leave comments, share them on Facebook, find links and events we mention on the air. Send your story ideas to mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.